Dr. Potts. He will speak to us, there he is, on human evolution and the origins of symbolic thought, culture, and spirituality. Rick.
Thank you very much, Daryl, and I want to thank especially Daryl and Dr. Wimmer for their very kind invitation to participate in this seminar and workshop. Are we okay?
Yep, just want to turn the mic up.
Yeah. Very good. Okay. And I'd like to start by noting that in my own interactions with theological study groups and faith communities around the U.S., particularly with clergy, helping to lead devotional aspects of life, I found that that in discussing areas of science that may indeed impact narratives of faith, relevant to faith, that there's either a sense that the scientific evidence is not interesting or important, best just left aside, or that it is important but represents a threat to doctrine and to faith, or there's an assumption that it is a threat, largely because that's what people have heard. It's rich in our culture, that conflict mode. And it's the only approach that generally is discussed. There's a third possibility that I've also seen, and that within faith communities, and especially again with clergy, that they just don't know where to begin. We don't know where to begin the discussion of scientific findings in a way that can adequately address how faith commitments may be challenged, reconciled, or potentially maybe be deepened as scientific discoveries are understood and explanations in science are integrated into a holistic understanding of the world, and especially with regard to the subject that where I do my scientific study, the evolution of human beings. From my own perspective, I hope that it's more of the third possibility than in the others, and that there is perhaps a viable way in which the discussion can be begun. And at the same time, I realize that the first and second perspectives are also widespread in many circles and communities. So what I'd like to try to do is, it's a real honor to be here to participate in conversations, dialogue, represented by this seminar, to perhaps provide a background for where to begin a discussion and how to prepare individuals and fellowships for a deeper examination of how scientific findings and religious understandings can commingle and further deepen our understanding of the world. And so I thought I would begin with a little anecdote about why discussions are important, why we must have conversations. And this comes from a really good friend of mine, Dr. Wes McCoy, a real hero of mine as a high school biology teacher in Cobb County, Georgia. And the anecdote to which he's given me permission to relate to you is that in teaching high school biology a couple of years ago, they were discussing major modifications of the Earth and impact craters relevant to the history of life and the extinction of dinosaurs and other events in the history of life. And he showed this picture of a famous impact crater in the southwest of the United States. And he noticed as he was about to move on to another image that one of the smartest kids in the class looked very troubled. And he said to her, you know, do you have a question? And she said, yeah, what is that at the bottom of the slide? And he looked at the slide. He said, oh, well, that's a geological research station. she thought for a moment, her brow furrowed, and she said, "Whoa, that was close." That's why we must have conversations. What I thought I would do here is to just give an outline of the talk. I'd like to provide an overview of human evolution, including core messages. And I'd like to point out some areas by which the Hall of Human Origins that Darryl mentioned and our companion book and our companion website may be of some use in pursuing some of those core messages when you have time on your own to do such things, to visit the Natural History Museum at the Smithsonian or to look on the web. I'd like to talk about some of the evidence that Darryl mentioned about the profound environmental change in which human evolution was ensconced, as well as the archaeological evidence relevant to the emergence of human thought, adaptability, which is one of the main themes and new narratives in the subject of human evolutionary history, and the emergence, also some archaeological evidence that is relevant perhaps to the emergence of the symbolic universe that human beings create, develop, and participate in all over the world. Of course, this is areas that get into some of the perhaps the one of the themes of the Templeton Foundation that we know so little but want to learn more. There's also, in addition to the matters of the origination of human characteristics, the characteristics that uniquely define our species among all other living beings, there's also the matter of extinction in our evolutionary history, and what is the meaning of that? And then I'd like to finish up by looking at what I consider some of the greatest challenges, but also some of the greatest opportunities for conversation and mutual understanding in the dialogue between science and religion. An overview of human evolution, of course, starts with discoveries, and often discoveries generally in the ground, sometimes in the human body, such as genetics and the human genome, and the genomes of other organisms. But in my area, it deals largely with bones and old stone tools and other artifacts of human behavior. The fossils relevant to human evolutionary history are generally deemed to go back as far as 6 million years into the past. And the archaeological finds of things that people made, the beginning of people leaving litter on the ground, starts at a little bit over 2.5 million years before the present. And so, actually, this is a very small amount of the Smithsonian collections relevant to this, and a very, very small amount that I'm showing here of the whole body of archaeological and fossil remains relevant to the subject of human origins that occur in all over the world, in countries, especially in Africa, Europe, and Asia, relevant to the deep time history of human ancestry. Actually, this is my office. One day when I wasn't there, someone took all the books off my shelves and put all these objects in and somehow put the books back. It's definitely not in the right order, but nonetheless, I'm really glad to have this photo. It's kind of fun to look at. And also, there have been it's a vibrant field of scientific investigation with new finds reported. Often these occur in front pages of newspapers and news magazines and things like that. On the left here, since I don't really have a pointer and can't really see, I'm just going to have to describe a little bit about what you're seeing there, is that on the left is a skeleton a little over 4 million years old called Ardi, which is a bit of an interesting conundrum and mystery that this fossil presents. And there's quite a bit of debate about it, but it shows the ability of walking upright on two legs, small canine teeth, eye teeth, in both males and females of this species. Those are the two characteristics that indicate a member of our family or evolutionary tree. Upright posture and walking and small canine teeth relative to all other members of the biological group that we belong to, the primates. But also has a number of characteristics like a divergent big toe, which is kind of odd to have in an otherwise bipedal skeleton. So a combination of features that look ape-like and human-like. Sahelanthropus, that's the oldest known skull that's relevant to human evolution based on, again, small canine teeth and the positioning of the hole underneath the skull, the foramen magnum, to which the spinal cord attaches to the brain. That is positioned underneath the skull, indicating an upright body. But we don't have yet the other portions of the skeleton yet, at least that have been published, to tell us whether this was a creature, if I may say that, a creature that walked. Homo floresiensis, affectionately known as the hobbit, which comes toward the end of the story, at least toward the present, a small biped, a toolmaker, maker of fire, that lived on the island of Flores, an evolutionary experiment that we, until 2004, we didn't know existed, but now have abundant evidence of this species on that island. And in fact, the Smithsonian is helping to run the field expeditions to Flores, uncovering more and more of this this fossil species. And we have a remarkable diversity of fossil humans that are known. The ones that I'm showing there on the bottom right are ones that come dated between 2 million and 1.5 million years ago from just in the region of northern Kenya, around Lake Turkana, indicating potentially three, potentially four lineages of upright walking human relatives and ancestors that lived in that region. We live in an unusual era from the standpoint of our evolutionary history, where there's only one species, all of us, Homo sapiens, one species worldwide. Whereas throughout much of human evolutionary history, the dense, increasingly dense fossil record is indicating multiple lineages of that look to be genetically separated because they have their own physical appearance that has continuity through time and parallel to one another of species that belong on our ancestral tree. And so this is, we can put it together like this from what we currently know and using the species that are widely recognized by scientists between 5 and 6 million years ago, between 4 and 5 million years ago, we have Ardi, the Ardipithecus, and as well as the beginning of some diversity in the family tree. The fossil, well-known fossil of Lucy is seen there on Australopithecus afarensis on the left. Between 2 and 3 million years ago, you have a bifurcation of the tree into the large-brained Homo group of species, and then the Paranthropus group of species, the large-toothed species. You have the first species known out of Africa, Homo erectus, sometimes in Africa known as Homo ergaster, between 2 and 1 million years ago, and then 1 million years ago to the present, we still have a diversity of early humans and relatives and ancestors. Homo heidelbergensis, you see there, is thought to be the common ancestor of Neanderthals and Homo sapiens. But at the time when Homo sapiens has been on Earth, the last 200,000 years, based on both fossil evidence as well as genetic evidence, you take all the genetic diversity of human beings today, and it comes back to the various genealogies of each of our genetic systems comes back to Africa and to a point about around 200,000 years ago. And so over the last 200,000 years ago, there still were also the Neanderthals, Homo floresiensis, and the last remaining species, the last remaining populations of Homo erectus were known. And what we see here then is a family tree that has had a considerable number of, from an evolutionary standpoint, we might say, experiments in being human. And yet, like the family trees of so many organisms, it is largely one that has involved not only the origination of absolutely fascinating traits, the things that distinguish us from all other living creatures, but also an evolutionary tree that's been prone to extinction, and that is one of the more ponderous things about human origins that we know at this point. The archaeological evidence and fossil evidence also gives us a lot of indications about the accumulation of human qualities over time. Part of the complexity of human beings is that we can trace the addition of qualities, of human qualities over time. So, for example, at the bottom of the screen, we have bipedal footprints known from the site of Laetoli in Tanzania dating back to a little over 3.5 million years ago, indicating the actual behavior. We don't have to interpret it from bones, but you actually see the behavior of bipeds walking across a volcanic landscape over 3.5 million years ago. We have exact replicas of these footprints actually in the Smithsonian exhibit. That set of that arc of skulls that you see there represents about 2.5 million years, just five skulls, but going from near present on the right to back to the left about 2.5 million years ago. And you can see the overall trend toward increasing brain size as well as the reduction in the size of the face, having to do with what these ancestors and relatives were eating. Over on the upper left, and that sweep all the way across, you have the 2.5 million years of changes in technology. Yeah, it sure was primitive, beginning with just sort of, you know, broken stones that were chipped, but in a very, very careful and intricate way, leading to sharp edges and pounding implements that basically opened up an immense range of food resources that no other animal could eat. You take the basic toolkit of a stone that you flake and the sharp pieces that fly off and the hammer stone that you need to knock off those flakes, and that cutting flake can cut better than a carnivore's canine, and that pounding implement can pound and crush better than an elephant's molar. And so the whole world of foods was opened up. And of course we have, the chopper on the furthest left toward hand axes, stone hand axes, beginning about 1.7 million years ago. To sewing needles. The oldest known sewing needles are about 32,000 years ago, years old. They come from China and represent, of course, an amazing period that begins a long time ago when human innovation started. And of course, the explosion of the symbolic world, especially over the last 50,000 years, that resulted in astonishing pieces of art and representations, expressions of human identity. What I'd like to do is then to talk a little bit about the Hall of Human Origins and what are some of our goals there have been, where we take these discoveries that I've mentioned to you in some of these themes and have presented them. The theme of our Hall of Human Origins is a question. It's not an answer. The Smithsonian will let you know what it means to be human. Rather, the theme is a question where we try to engage and to acknowledge the fact that people bring into, well, every part of their lives an understanding of humanness that that is informed by religion, by philosophy, by the arts, literature, the arts in general, everyday experience, and can be, to some degree at least, articulated with science. And so it is a respectful and welcoming place where everyone can explore some of the milestones in the evolution of humans. And what we see is in the background there is the backbone of the hall where we invite the public to look at various benchmarks or milestones in the development of walking upright on two legs, of the development of tools and the changes in diet and new foods, changes in the body, of course, but also the brain and social life, which can be traced to some degree through the archaeological record and the origin of our capacity to symbolize and to create complex symbolic language as our means of communicating with one another and creating our symbolic universe in which that is an enormous way in which people have been able to not only survive, but to develop a richness of understanding about the world. This is one of my favorite art pieces in the exhibit. The visitor has to sit down with it to complete the artwork, which is receiving a chunk of bone and meat from Homo heidelbergensis, situated at a fire. We present, of course, a whole body of fossil evidence. Of course, one of the biggest challenges I had as curator was to get objects from 48 different countries and a whole variety of institutions to contribute to this exhibit. It wasn't actually very hard once I learned the Smithsonian wanted to do this. And present something about the diversity of species, helping the public understand why the whole range of things that we present maybe and are relevant to the subject of human origins from a scientific standpoint. We also have a area where we celebrate and acknowledge and hopefully help the public understand something about that we are one species today, spread all over the world. The origin in Africa, that our every cell in our body, every nucleus in our cell bears the echo of that African origin, as well as gives us the ability to trace the genealogy of people and the movement of peoples around the world. This is also a theater space where we turn off the video at least once a month to present what we call our hot topics, human origins today topics, and every other month, the hot topics is devoted to the relationship between science and religion vis-a-vis the subject of human origins. Daryl has participated in that, and we have members of what we call our broader social impacts team, representatives of faith communities from around the country who lead those town hall discussions. The next one will actually be next Friday, the 16th. Usually it's the last weekend, last Friday of every month, but with Thanksgiving, we decided to have it a week early this month. We hope that you will use the exhibit for those of you who are local as a resource in what I'm discussing here, and also our website, an extensive website. Right on the home page, there is a section on religious perspectives on human origins. You click on that, and that takes you to our page for this broader social impacts team that I mentioned, where people, the members of that team, the members of that group, as I say, from faith communities from around the country, give their own personal perspectives on their understanding of how, from their religious perspectives of how it ties into the subject, the science of human origins. And so what I'd like to do is just briefly go through some of the core concepts about human evolution that are exhibited in the hall. You can follow on the website, and here they are. The origin of the distinctive features of our species didn't occur all at once. They did not they occurred as an accumulation over time, which I've already mentioned. And there is abundant evidence for the accumulation of what we would see as scientists as adaptations of ways of interacting with the surroundings. The surroundings, of course, being our social surroundings, not just our physical and biotic surroundings, but also our social surroundings, but related to how we walk, how our brains work, how we interacted with our surroundings, how our social behavior became so elaborate, and so on. And so this is a rather complicated slide, but all it's meant to do is to show from the bottom to the top, it's a timeline. A timeline, Ka represents thousands of years ago, Na, millions of years ago, and some of the things that occurred over time through the accumulation of human characteristics. By the way, I'm very happy to leave this slide presentation here or whatever, if anyone would like to have a copy of it for your contemplation. we'll try to figure out a way to do that. But from bipedal walking to increase in the foods that were eaten, simple stone flaking, the carrying of stones and food, elongation of the legs representing a commitment to life on the ground, advances, at least initial advances in stone technology by 1.7 million years ago. The most rapid increase in relative brain size occurred over the last 800,000 years. The control of fire and building shelters, essentially the development of home bases, a place that we would call home, where as we separate out at the beginning of the day, we know that that's the place to come back to. Very significant thing in the origin of human beings. Complex spatial mapping and resource exchange by 250,000 years ago. I'll show you some evidence in a few minutes why we now think this goes back to more than 300,000 years ago. And we look at that, like, how can you know that? Well, by knowing our rocks and by tracing the chemistry of rocks to places where the original outcrops were and seeing how far those were transported and the evidence for that. And of course, symbolic behavior, beginning with coloring material, the accumulation of pigments, of red and black pigments, and then the emergence, of course, various forms of artistic expression. And then what we see over the last 100,000 years is a great expansion in the diverse ways of being human, cultural diversification and technological innovation, especially over that time. Another core concept, Homo sapiens is connected to all other living organisms on the planet. That's a foundational principle of evolution in general. There is continuity with the evolved characteristics of humans with those of our primate relatives. Now, there's a challenge for many people. And then number four, as we've already talked about, our species is the only one left of a diverse evolutionary tree of earlier species. Numbers are how scientists work in many cases, not just the discovery of fossils, but genetic similarity is shown. Every person in the room here is 99.9% genetically similar to everyone else in the room. And if you were to compare your genome with someone from Norway or Papua New Guinea or South America or Africa or Siberia, you find the same result, 99.9% genetic similarity. But we also have a genetic similarity with other organisms, for all other organisms on the planet. And this creates, again, quite a profound implication for our understanding of through this, the study of evolution, and particularly through genomics. And this, so genealogy, genetic similarity, or genomic similarity, reflects genealogy and relationships, and can help trace the history of dispersal of peoples around the world. You may think the weirdest fact where they're 60% similar to a banana. What's that all about? Well, it turns out that the first 3+ billion years of life on Earth was cellular life. And refining the cellular operations, the basic operations of a cell, is what the genome is very much wrapped up in doing. And so that explains why, when you look at the comparison of the genome, there's, you know, banana trees are cellular organisms too, just like we are, and that accounts for quite a lot of that, basically all of that genetic similarity. But there is a profound feeling that primatologists sense when looking at and being invested in studying and being with other primates. And here we see the hand of Jane Goodall reaching that of a chimpanzee that she knows very well. And there's a powerful connection to be made. People can be threatened by this. I'm not a monkey, I'm not an ape, I'm not an animal. But yes, we are. And there's beauty to that sense of the connectivity of all forms of life and that kinship that exists. And that kinship, and particularly, again, the studies of genomic similarity and the study of the origin of human beings through the fossil record, Also leads us to contemplate in considerable detail the ways in which not our ancestor, okay, chimpanzees are not our ancestor, but we shared a common ancestor with chimpanzees. And that common ancestry has led to an independent development within chimpanzees that has striking parallels to things that we see in our own behavior sometimes. The ability to make tools, sure, not the sophisticated tools that would lead us to go to the moon, but nonetheless, the ability to make and use tools, the context, the intense sociality and social interactions of all primates with one another, their ability to learn. It takes about 2 years for an infant chimpanzee to learn how to crack nuts with an anvil and hammersmith. It's a process, just like it's a process of learning in ourselves, in each one of us. And so when you embed yourself in the life of a primate, of our other members of our evolutionary group, there are profound things to think about with regard to their complexity of their social lives and their thought processes. Core concepts continued. Human ancestors evolved in dramatically changing surroundings, and these presented particular survival challenges. I'll go over that in a moment. And the benefits of particular adaptations came at a cost. That's one of the hallmarks of evolution. Standing upright on two legs meant that all body weight was placed on just two limbs rather than four. I don't know about you, but I certainly sometimes feel the costs of evolution in my arches and my back and my knees sometimes. And also there are tremendous survival challenges that occurred with the emergence of the enlarged human brain, obviously giving birth to a large-headed infant as poses particular problems at the time of birth. I'll go over that in a moment. But I'd like to just introduce to you very briefly where my second home is. It's on that cliff. I don't know if you can see, there's a little line of green tents up on a cliffside in the upper left-hand corner there. And that's my home for 3 months out of the year. And the Rift Valley of southern Kenya, the site of the Lurgis Sile is the name of that. It's a site where these hills, eroded hills and gullies, represent a spectacular sedimentary archive representing the last 1 million years, filled with stone artifacts, fossilized bones, and evidence of environmental change. And each hillside represents a slice of time, an interval of time. This particular interval, based again on argon-argon dating, the decay the chemical of potassium to argon gas, allows us to date each individual volcanic eruption with considerably greater precision than anything that was possible, say, 20, 30 years ago. This particular hillside represents about 10,000 years of time. And if you look at just a small slice of that, representing about 2,000 years, you see this amazing back and forth between dry and wet, including sometimes dramatic changes between consecutive intervals of intense drought, the drying up of a lake and the formation of a salt flat, to then evidence from the diatoms, the microorganisms in the layer above it, of a very fresh and deep and broad lake that filled up that area of the Rift Valley. Well, this understanding and seeing this dynamic of environments through time really made me scratch my head about 20 years ago and led me to retool my own understandings into the environmental sciences and study the environmental sciences. And sorry to show such a complicated graph, but this is the iconic diagram of global climate change over the last 10 million years, 10 million on the right, going to the present on the left. This is from the study of microorganisms that are studied by coring into the deep sea and getting long, long cores where one can study the oxygen composition of these particular microorganisms. And they give an indication of warm and cold and the fluctuation over time. And what I would point out to you is that over the last 6 million years in particular, 6 million, ring a bell? Well, it happens to be the time period of our own evolutionary history, that there's been increasing climate fluctuation, instability of the environment, environmental uncertainty. And if we look at the main groups of species, genera, main groups of species in our own evolutionary tree, we see that the genus Homo, to which we belong as Homo sapiens, emerged as climate fluctuation became greater and greater and greater. And so this has led, in a sense, to a new narrative of human evolutionary history, where it's not just been a matter of, well, how did human characteristics evolve as a means of survival of a single challenging past environment, ancestral environment, but rather it's a matter of how walking upright and how making stone tools, how having a large brain and how creating symbols and language represented ways of adjusting, of accommodating to a widely changing environment. And so in this new narrative, we have a change in our perspective from a concept of that used to be called human nature, that was narrowly defined, and a concept of genetic constraint to a particular ancestral environment, and a concept of biological inevitability. If you go back 20, 30 years and read books about human evolution, and even some still today, you will see that those are the themes that are woven through the narrative of human origins. But those are beginning to be replaced through these sorts of understandings, which ones where, rather than biological inevitability, we're talking about resilience. We're talking about plasticity and adaptability, a decoupling of the human organism from any particular inevitability or biological constraint. And I think that's a very important area that is emerging. It's becoming part of textbooks now and becoming part of our emerging understanding of human evolutionary history. And I'll get back to that at the end of the talk. And so we see, actually, the greatest increase in brain size. This is a plot. But a plot of early human skull brain sizes, cranial capacity, as it's called, over the last 3.5 million years. And the greatest rate, the fastest rate of brain size increase is largely over the last 1 million years, again, as climate fluctuation was increasing. And when we think about what our brains are good for, well, they're the most plastic, not only the most complex organ that has ever been evolved, but the most plastic, the most flexible organ that has ever been evolved. But of course, there are some disadvantages to the brain. And brains are really, as organs go, not a very good deal. The human brain represents about 2% of our body weight, but they take up 20 to 25% of our energy, even at rest. Probably mine is a little bit higher than that right at the moment, as I'm standing here. And so we have not only a large brain, but a very hungry brain that needs to be fueled. And that is related then to the fact that we are an energy-seeking species. And we seek out the richest energy sources with regard to our foods. And that we can see that all the way back to 2.5 million years ago when brain size did begin to increase. And that has become increasingly important. One of the weirdest things that human beings do, I cannot impress upon you enough, the fact that we delay in our eating of food. Generally, when I'm in a supermarket, I don't just sit down in the aisle and start ripping the knife. And I bet you don't either. But rather, we do something very unusual. We actually get the food and we take it someplace else, generally with a sense that we're going to have others eating with us and sharing in the food. And that's a very, very unusual thing that human beings do. And of course, it's a wonderful way, if you look at it from a survival standpoint, of buffering the failure in your individual quest for food, that you pool resources. And so we see from the outset of that at around 2.5 million years ago, but an increase in that over time. Prolonged maturation, the fact that we have large brains mean that we're born at an altricial state, at a very undeveloped state, and that we really require an immense amount of parental or adult energy in raising each one of us as we grow up. And so that involves a cooperative care. of young. I'm not so sure whether donuts and Duff beer, by the way, represent food, rich food sources. So there are advantages and disadvantages. One of the great advantages is, you know, we think of the brain as gray matter. Well, the gray matter are the cell bodies. That's what's gray, okay? Cell bodies. We have in our neocortex that large expanded covering of the brain, outer surface of the brain, with all that complex convolutions in the brain surface. We have the same number of neural bodies, neurons, as in the neocortex of a chimpanzee. So what's there to gray matter? It hasn't really increased. What's different is white matter. White matter is all the connective tissue, all the connective neurons and dendrites that mean that the cells are communicating with one another. And that's the source of human plasticity. Okay, that's the source of being able to integrate all the different sensory information and to make connections between things that, frankly, no other organism can make connections on those various sensory inputs. And from that comes matters of thought. Our prefrontal cortex, our frontal lobe in general, is one of the most greatly expanded areas of our brain. And from studies in neuroscience, sometimes largely through the study of injuries that people have had to their frontal lobes and prefrontal cortex, we realize that the frontal lobe, the prefrontal cortex, where there's so many connections to every other part of the brain, is also the seat of awareness. It's the seat of concentration and focus and cognitive motivation, planning. When that area of the brain is damaged, all sorts of unusual behaviors, inappropriate social behaviors, occur. A loss of concentration. Also a loss sometimes of our ability to speak with one another and to articulate things that go beyond the present day situation, but rather to articulate things about the past, memories about the past, or to anticipate aspects of the future, conditionalities. And so the connectivity of the brain is very much wrapped up with its increase in size. And so let me present this same group of evolutionary traits that have accumulated over time. And in this new narrative then, we then, as those of us who study human evolutionary history, see that these involve particular adaptive benefits that afforded a certain flexibility and resilience and adaptability of our species. So that bipedal walking was coupled with tree climbing, and that allowed the ability to buffer changes in environment between plate times when there were many trees to times when there were very few. With stone flaking, it expanded the ability to process new foods, meat, marrow, underground plants. The carrying of food improved ability to adjust to changes in food supply. And we can go up this list here and see how adaptability becomes this theme throughout this. And that there's been a sense, a process of liberation, if you will, of human behavior to any particular way of being, of any particular survival challenge, and a decoupling of human life from the constraints of any one survival context. And then, of course, when we get up to spatial mapping and resource exchange, a larger store of information, greater capacity to imagine and plan. And, of course, today there are many ways of being human in the world. The diversity of cultures around the world lead us to an expanded range of adaptive options, but also an expanded range of ways of being human. Finally, core concept number 7 that I wanted to present is that discoveries pertaining to human evolution uncover changes in some of the defining qualities of our species, Homo sapiens, and yet our usage of the word human is much broader than what science and evolution deals with. Okay. And so that's a very important thing that I believe is a core concept about human evolution. And so if we wanted to try to understand why people have a sense of the sacred and the spiritual in specific ways. We wouldn't necessarily look to our deep evolutionary past to understand the specifics of that. If we want to understand why children do the things they do, we wouldn't necessarily look to evolution to help to try to account for why that boy on the left is contemplating doing that. And why that boy, oh, sorry, two boys on the right are having this sense, this theory of mind that what they're doing will be funny to someone else. And so there are many things that that science can't really even begin to explore or to explain the specifics of. However, by looking at the archaeological record and the fossil record, there are a number of interesting things that we can talk about that are relevant to the topic of the rest of the seminar today. This is one of our excavations in western Kenya on the shores of Lake Victoria, the site of Kenjera, around 2 million years old. And from this particular archaeological site, we see extensive evidence of animal parts being carried to the archaeological site with butchery marks on those animal bones, as well as evidence from the edges of stone tools of plants having been processed at that place. Plants from several different environments that would have occurred in that area. And so there's the carrying of food and the carrying of stone material from greater than 12 kilometers away. It doesn't sound like much today, perhaps, in our enormous global networks of trade, but that is huge back then, 2 million years ago. And so this idea of bringing things to a place where you expected others to be goes back at least that far. And the delayed eating of food, therefore, would have can be traced back that far in the sense of sharing, of whether it's out of self-interest because you're trying to, you know, if I do this, maybe you will do this too, bring food to the same place. And when I fail and being able to find food on a particular day, that maybe you'll have something and we'll share it together. Maybe out of such humble and perhaps trite roots comes something important with regard to the development of human morality and ethics, especially when embraced within a symbolic system and universe that comes later on in time. From the reconstruction at the top is based on an 800,000-year-old site, which is the earliest evidence of hearths, multiple hearths from a site in Israel. And at the bottom reconstruction is based on a 400,000-year-old site from France, southern France, where we see evidence of post holes and grouping of stones indicating the building of an investment in a relatively long-lasting shelter. And so between 800 and 400,000 years ago, based on the evidence we have right now, we do have evidence of home bases, of permanent places for food sharing and the integration of group activities and the sense of responsibilities that must have resulted and been part of that system of behavior. The prolonging of our maturation, one of the most profound things in human life, the immense energy that adults put into their children, growing up, it's an astonishing process, and we have the most prolonged maturation of any primate, of any mammal, certainly. And much of what's familiar about our lives stems from this prolonged, it's called life history, this prolonged development, including how we care for others, how we seek partners, how we create social alliances and learn and build up cultural knowledge, all stems from this prolonged maturation. We have unique childhood and adolescent phases. There is no childhood phase that is after weaning that we then depend upon our parents or adults in general for food. When weaned, all other primates start to fend for themselves. Well, we have a unique childhood period, and for better or for worse, also a unique adolescent phase. In which sexual activity is much delayed beyond the growth of a secondary growth spurt that doesn't occur in any other primate, in any other other mammal. And grandparents, too, although I really don't know how that says old age up there begins at 50. I think. That's that's just not right. That's a typo, yeah. Yeah, unfortunately, it's also a typo in our exhibit. So. I must have approved it at some point late at night. And from looking at fossils, for example, this 1.5 million year old fossil, and from the teeth, you can do microscopic studies of the teeth, and the layers of enamel in the teeth are laid down one day at a time. And you can actually count the number of days from birth, which is the cessation of laying down of enamel, because birth is the most stressful thing that you will ever undergo. And your growth that's going on at that moment stops for a day or two. And you can actually see the line in the microscopic studies of the teeth of where that growth, that laying down of enamel stops, and you can then count the number of days it took for that tooth to grow and to erupt. And from that, we can see, in this particular fossil individual, that it looks like us in terms of long legs and basically a human-like body. And yet, in its second molar was erupted. You may realize that your second molar erupts in us around the age of 12 years old. This individual, the second molar, had erupted at the age of 7.5. A human-like body growing at the rate of a great ape. In fact, even faster than most great apes today. And so this combination of features that helps us understand that the prolonging of our life history had not occurred by 1.5 million years ago. But actually, as we trace fossils through these tooth studies through time, it occurred in the last 1 million, especially the last 500,000 years. Very interesting. Once the human brain attained its current size. And so all these things are wrapped up with one another. We also learned something that's relevant to this topic of the seminar, perhaps through looking at injury. This perhaps relates to matters of suffering. And this particular individual, 65,000 years ago, 65,000 years ago, a Neanderthal individual that was buried in a cave in northern Iraq from the site of Shanidar. And you may sort of see that it's the left side of the skull that's on the right side that you're seeing, but the left side of the individual was crushed in and had healed. And that crushing occurred early in life, and the entire right side of the body, the left side, the left brain controlled the right side of the body. The whole right side of the body was withered. And you can see the right and left humerus, upper arm bone, and how withered that was. And this was an individual who lived for decades, died around the age of 50 years old, 45, 50 years old, had been cared by a social group. Even more profound than that is going back to 1.8 million years ago. Sorry, I didn't find my slide with this last night while putting this together. But 1.8 million years ago, a fossil skull from the Republic of Georgia, the site of Dimonisi, again, dated back to 1.8 million years ago, an old man, where the teeth had been lost and the bone had been resorbed in the jaw, and that had been going on for years. We know this on the basis of forensics and basic anatomy. And that individual had to have been fed, could not have eaten its food, but someone must have been processing it or chewing it and feeding it to the individual all the way back to 1.8 million years ago, the sense of care and nurturing for one another. Maybe a very close relative, but nonetheless, someone different from that individual. And even stone tools helps us understand something about the emergence of this sense of morality and symbolic universe and eventually spirituality itself. This comes from our studies at the site of the Lord Gisaili in southern Kenya. And what we've been studying is that what we've been able to see is that between 500,000 and 300,000 years ago, there was a major change in stone technology and behavior. And that the long-existing, stable, very adaptable, obviously, hand axe tradition passed away. And by 316,000 years ago, we have the beginning of what's called the Middle Stone Age. The origin of the human ability to innovate begins around that time. And a smaller, more mobile technology, innovations including, just look at this one on the bottom here, with a single strike, over and over again, single strikes would produce triangular points. These are the first projectile points, things that fly through the air. The world has never been the same since. And so such innovations as that, but also at the bottom there, you may notice the sort of color reddish and orange colored rocks, the accumulation of red and black pigments at the site of coloring material, which is generally thought to be the root of the human ability to symbolize. And so we have these oldest known pigments between 316,000 and 250,000 years ago. We can actually see the microscopic striations where they were actually rubbing the pigment off onto something. We don't know what they were applying it to. We wish we could know that, but we haven't been able to find exactly what they applied it to, perhaps to their skin, perhaps some other wood or some other thing that has decayed. But nonetheless, oldest known pigments. And so we have with this Middle Stone Age, if we look across Africa in general, this is a timeline from 280 or 300,000 years ago to about 20,000 years ago. You can see this series of innovations. The human ability to be creative begins to express itself over the last 300,000 years. And so we see these various benchmarks and behavioral innovations through time in our work. We haven't published it yet, so you're saying this before everyone else does, that long-distance exchange of stone, trade, basically, goes back older than 300,000 years ago. The developing of social alliances, of recognition of values, if you will, of something that is valuable, rocks, obsidian, extremely valuable because they're so sharp. That's what those projectile points were made out of. That comes from a rock that's 100 kilometers away. And it's not being chipped and used as a group is moving back and forth across the landscape. Large chunks of it are coming, jumping space, coming to the southern Kenya Rift Valley. And that must mean exchange. And that must mean a sense of common and shared understanding of the value, at least of that rock. What else might it represent as well in terms of shared value and shared understandings? We don't know. And so all of these things represent increasing innovation, wider social networks, the beginning of complex symbolic activity, and expressions of the human imagination. And of course, we have here a whole variety of things that go back through time. The upper left there, that's the world's oldest crayon. It doesn't look very much like a Crayola, I admit. But from a site in Zambia called Twin Rivers, we have a whole variety of these faceted pieces of pigment that are faceted, just as you see there, just like a crayon would be. From rubbing it, in this case red and orange pigment and yellow pigment, going back to 250,000 years ago. The oldest piece of representational art at the very top from a site called Apollo 11 Cave in Zimbabwe. Hard to know what that represents. Many people think that the legs look a little bit more human-like. Others think it looks like, well, it's just an animal of some sort. But then 42,000 years ago, you have at the bottom the world's oldest musical instrument. Again, the ability of humans to express themselves in sound and music and a sense of beauty. And also from a nearby cave 42,000 years ago, the ability to create something that doesn't exist. A combination of what's called the lion man, walking upright on two legs and yet with a lion's head on top. Again, an expression of the human imagination. What this represented to the people, again, Homo sapiens who lived there at that time, we don't exactly know. And then, of course, over the last 40,000 years, the human ability to express beautiful pieces of art, as well as a sense of identity, the leaving of handprints that occurs on every continent. Of the globe, well, not Antarctica, I suppose, but every other continent. So leaving behind a sense of one's identity. And the ability to, as we create symbolic worlds in our own minds that we share as part of our social groups, that within inside of caves in Africa and in Europe especially, where these, if I may call them, if you'll allow me, cathedrals of human expression, that there is this ability of taking the outer world and symbolically representing it inside the cave, much as we symbolically represent it in our own minds. Burial. Extraordinary burials that are known over the last 40,000 years. The oldest known burial goes back to, a purposeful burial, goes back to 130,000 years ago, a site of Homo sapiens in Israel, the site of Kosser. And that burial also had grave goods, so it wasn't just a matter of disposal of the body, but some sort of sense of ritual of let's leave with this person, this individual who I know, something for perhaps an afterlife. Perhaps most interesting is the fact that what is generally recognized as a separate species from our own, the Neanderthals, also buried their dead. Does this blur the line between modern human and archaic human? This is from 45,000 years ago. And what's interesting here, this actually comes from a picture in the Smithsonian archives. I didn't realize we had this until last night when I was looking through the archives and putting this together for you. But this particular skeleton was buried with wild flowers. And you can actually see in our exhibit a diorama that explains how we know that. So seven different forms of wild flower where flowers were buried with this individual. A sense of ritual and something expressive of an afterlife. The Neanderthals, of course, are no longer around. They are extinct, and that leads to one of the final themes here. And that is that we have all these complex names of species. And they all come with numbers of when was the oldest known fossil and when was the last known fossil of those species. And yet, these were individuals. These were people with, these were individuals with some components, sometimes some very significant components of what it means to be a human being. And so, for example, with the Neanderthals who lived in Europe, we know that they had brains as large as Homo sapiens. Some larger even than most human populations today, and that they sometimes made symbolic artifacts. They buried their dead on occasion, at least. They made tools as sophisticated, almost as sophisticated as Homo sapiens, who lived around the same time, and yet they are no longer around. Homo erectus on the upper left there, look how long it lived, more than 1.8 million years. Nine times longer than our own species has been on Earth. We assume that we're on the top of the heap, that we're the evolutionary success. It's pretty successful too, but it's no longer on the face of the Earth. It represents a way of life that is no longer to be found here, except through our archaeological discoveries. And so the idea that human beings are the last remaining species of a diverse family tree leads us to also inspect this matter of extinction, which is perhaps the most existential problem that exists in the study of human evolutionary history. And it's profound. It's profound to us as scientists thinking about this. And what's even more interesting are the whole variety of genomics labs around the world who have found out that human genetic diversity, despite all the outward diversity of the different ways that people look, human genetic diversity is tiny compared with most other living organisms. And that is indicative of what's known as a genetic bottleneck, a population crash in our species. And there are huge debates about how big that crash was. But you know what? The debates are that our species was reduced to a breeding population of 10,000 individuals to maybe as few as 600. Okay. And that we almost became extinct. But what are the implications of that? That even in Homo sapiens, we almost became extinct. But there are these powers of resilience and adaptability that apparently then has led to 7 billion and counting today. And so I just want to finish up then with a very brief list of concerns and apprehensions and challenges and opportunities for conversation. Many of the concerns and apprehensions are certainly when the science is presented within a religious context, have to do with existential concerns. That, well, you know, evolution means that humans are just a speck, and I reject that. Or humans are just an accident, and I reject that. Concerns about values, therefore. That evolution, I've heard this many times before, evolution erodes my core values, and I just won't have it. There are also, of course, biblical and doctrinal concerns that will be addressed in the coming lectures today. With regard to obstacles, there are misrepresentations of what science and evolution are all about. But there are equally disconcerting are mischaracterizations of religious insights and commitments by some scientists. And then there's the representation of, rather, there's the surveys that reinforce the science and religion divide. So many times, surveys are multiple choice. You get to pick your either science or evolution or a doctrinal stance on religious creation. And I have found, as I've gone around the country and talking with people, that people want to have both. They're excited about the scientific discoveries. They love finding out about them, and yet the insights and commitments of their religion are so important and valuable to us. And so is there a ground for conversation? So here are what I think are the greatest challenges posed in a religious context by human evolution. The extinction of species, especially the idea that humans, Homo sapiens, almost became extinct, is a particular problem for many people. We're not, this doesn't evolution mean then we're not special? Well, my religion teaches us that we are special. We have a special relationship to the divine, to the sacred, and to the creator. Common ancestry, and here common ancestry means that we're related to all other organisms, indicates or suggests that we don't have an independent origin for humanity, which is what I've always learned in my religious context, in my religious community. Natural selection. Well, with natural selection, that's one of the core processes of evolution. And what that means, the challenge here is through natural selection, is that it explains, or said to explain, the origin of all living things, including human beings. And yet this is a material process. A natural material process, not necessarily at all a divine one. And then survival and adaptability. And here the idea is that processes of the natural world, such as environmental instability and climate change, can be studied without reference to human action or divine purpose. And that is a challenge within a religious context. At the same time, I think that there are very significant opportunities presented by the science of human evolution for positive dialogue, positive religion-science conversation. And here's the list of those opportunities that I think exist. Extinction. Extinction brings up the fragility of life. And its preciousness. And this occurs not just only in a religious context, but also in a scientific context. We feel it as scientists. And it also brings up, in addition to fragility and preciousness, the importance of events in time that can make a difference to human life. And there's real ground for communication and conversation about that, especially, I believe, a Christian religious context. Common ancestry. Well, here, the theme is kinship. And with kinship comes compassion. Okay? And the idea that that kinship exists not only through all of humanity, but of how humans connect with all other living creatures. That's a kinship that makes us a part of something far broader than we could have ever imagined. Okay? And I think that's grounds for conversation in a religious context. Natural selection, well, natural selection presents some real challenges here. And here we meet the problem of suffering that's so apparent in the natural world and in human life. And we face, of course, in a religious context, the matter of suffering in the context of a loving God, the problem of theodicy. Well, I've wondered in this particular contemplating natural selection, whether natural selection indeed provides a natural foundation for understanding, not just success and survival, but also suffering and the possibility of extinction and injury. A natural foundation for understanding suffering that need not be linked to decisions that God makes for Christians and for all human beings, and the decisions that human beings make about going toward God or moving away from God. And this is potentially a complicated area for discussion. But I think that there is more common ground for discussion than might ordinarily be thought. Then with regard to survival and adaptability, again, this brings to the fore our sources of resilience within us, personally and as a society. And as we face challenges ahead, these sources will need to include not just the fixes and solutions of technology, but also a robust combination of what science helps us to understand and our beliefs and understandings that arise from religious teachings and insights. And so this emerging narrative that I've spoken to you about with regard to plasticity, resilience, and adaptability characterizes Homo sapiens as an evolved animal that is freed from biological inevitability and genetic constraints. And this account converges on the matter of how humans have come to possess a capacity for freedom, free will. And that's certainly a topic that converges on religious understandings about freedom and free will. And finally, I would just like to add one more point here of an opportunity, and that's a shared sense of awe. This matter of a shared sense of awe is something that comes, that is certainly sensed by scientists understanding the history of life, and human beings as a part of it. And it's an area of common ground in matters of religious communities and teachings. And I realize a shared sense of awe is not enough by itself. But a conversation about awe, I think, will find a shared space that transcends strict tenets and rehearsed positions that often cause more strife than they should. And so, as you've already noted, as we compare these two lists of the greatest challenges and the greatest opportunities for real conversation, they are the same list. And the implication here is that conversation that embraces the most deeply rooted concerns about existence, suffering, and our place in the world is truly a genuine conversation. And all I can finish with is that I am truly grateful for the opportunity to participate in a forum that is dedicated to that real conversation. Thanks very much. It operates through genetic variation. Mutation is one process of genetic variation. The recombining of genes, of course, also creates variation that creates the diversity for the creativity of the natural world, yes.
By means of this process, can you identify any knowledge of a single instance of positive information being achieved through these mutations?
Yes, absolutely. We now know that the genome is the human genome is huge, and only about 2% of the human genome represent genes. That is, things that actually code for proteins, and the vast majority of variations within the genome, as it's passed on from parent to offspring, that would be called mutations, if you will, has to do with what's often been called, what was originally called, the junk DNA. But we now know that the junk DNA involves all sorts of duplications of genes that allow, that permit functions to persist while at the same time having the physiology of the cell, the physiology of tissues and organs, have the freedom, in a sense, to experiment with new functions. And so all the way from the things that are deleterious, such as certain diseases related to cancer, to various things related to behavioral difficulties with regard to autism, things like that. But yes, mutations can have serious effects in those areas. But we also see that improvements in terms of protein output that relate to protection against disease have also emerged as a result of these sorts of things. I've been working with the NIH, with the National Institute, the National Human Genome Research Institute, and their scientists in developing an exhibit that will open at our Natural History Museum next year on the Human Genome Project. And there we explore some of the areas of both positive and negative effects that have come through the sorts of genetic variations I just referred to.